Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. The MERS team discusses what could be the most competitive primaries, as well as who could be the most vulnerable incumbents in the 2024 state house elections. More than 100 state representatives are running for re-election, and more than 32% of them are facing primary challengers. Additionally, State Senator Veronica Kleinfeld, an East Point Democrat, joins today's episode to discuss her legislation to explicitly outlaw the sexual abuse and assault of dead bodies in Michigan, a prohibition that does not currently exist. Executive Director Robert McCann of the K-12 Alliance of Michigan explains why school districts want legislators to stay on top of paying down retirement debt for public school employees. Robert explains how districts and individual educators have their own obligations to the debt, which he would like to see the state work toward alleviating. Now here's MERS podcast host Samantha Schreiber, editor Kyle Malin, House reporter Danielle James, and political reporter Maggie George.
Thank you so much, Jeff Smith, for warming up our episode today of the MERS Monday podcast. He is taking over this week for our formal producer, Mark Bayshore of Mark Bayshore Audio out in Okemos. Now, we are going to be beginning things a little bit different on this episode of MERS Monday. We are going to be kicking off with a roundtable staff-led discussion featuring members of the MERS team. We are here with Danielle James, our state house reporter for MERS, Maggie George, our political reporter for MERS News, and also Kyle Malin, the editor. The reason why we are doing a staff roundtable is because the individuals that I just mentioned have been really deep in the thick weeds of preparing our 2024 election guide and almanac. Last week was a candidate filing deadline for individuals wanting to run for state office, especially the state house. So these individuals have been spending hours creating profiles, getting to meet some of the new primaries. We are specifically zooming in on the state house, which all seats are up for re-election these 2024 elections, kicking off of a primary election in August, and then afterward with the general election in November. And the dynamics are a little bit different here too as well. For example, November 2022, we saw the passage of financial disclosure reform as well as term limit reform. Now you have individuals that can remain in the state house, if successful, for a whole 12 years, running for re-election every 2 years. Now, Kyle, I apologize that I have completely forgotten now that we're in the new era of these new term limits, but what was it beforehand?
As far as?
The state house.
So in the past, what we would have is we would have like these cycles where we would have every term, there would be a cycle of legislators that would be 25 to 40-ish deep who would not be seeking re-election. So they would just be naturally cycled out. Now with the term limits change, what we have is people who could run for a fourth term and a fifth term and a sixth term, but then they would not be able to run for the Senate. There are many legislators who are deciding to take that tack. In fact, there are only three that decided that they want to leave the legislature, leave the House early, so that conceivably they could run two terms in the Senate. That is Felicia Braybeck, Andrew Beeler, and just recently Abraham Ayash, who would all fall in that category. Otherwise, we have 102 legislators who are in the state house who are looking for another term. That includes 24 who are going to be seeking a fourth term, which is something that they were not able to do since the term limits law.
And just to confirm, you were able to spend three terms in the House, and a lot of times that individual would then pursue two terms in the Senate.
That's correct. And you can't do that anymore. You can do two terms in the House and two terms in the Senate, and that would get you 12 years. And that is the new maximum number of years that you can serve combined in the legislature. And so what we're seeing then is 24 state house people trying to seek that fourth term. But as a result, what you're seeing are these members facing primaries, because what you would have in prior cycles is that if you were interested in running for the House, you would just wait out the legislator. The legislator won the first term. And unless you were in the city of Detroit, where people primary folks all the time, you would have an incumbent running basically unopposed in a primary for the second term and the third term. Well, now you can't wait them out anymore. Now it's, you can wait until 12 years and folks don't have that kind of patience. So yeah, we have 33 facing a primary this time. Since Ayash dropped out, it was 34. Ayash dropped out, so now it's 33. But that is a very high number of folks facing a primary.
Yeah, so I think my next question is do we have any blasts from the past coming back? Somebody that did their three terms in the House and now they're coming back because they get to do a bonus term.
We have six, as a matter of fact. We have Richard Steenland, who was defeated in the last election in 2022. He is returning. LaTanya Garrett, who is term limited out. She's making a return and challenging Helena Scott in the state house in the Detroit district. Gary Eisen, who was defeated by Andrew Beeler when the two were drawn in together in 2022. He is making a return. Beeler's not running this time because he's conceivably likely going to be running for the Senate. Tim Kelly, who is a folk who has ran for Congress before, he has run for the state Senate before. He is making a return in the state House. He does not have a primary, and the district is very Republican, so he'll likely return. And then we have two people who are running again, who are now challenging an incumbent from the other party and setting up a situation where those districts are going to be competitive in November. First is Tim Sneller over in Genesee. He's going to be facing David Martin in November, and that's going to be a competitive primary. And then in West Michigan, where we have Tommy Brand is going to be coming back, and he is going to be facing John Fitzgerald in Wyoming, which will also be a very competitive race.
I think I want to start with asking you a question, Danny. I mean, obviously, the 2022 elections was your first election cycle on the MERS team. What do you think are the major differences between the energy of 2022 and the energy now as we are in the full swing of 2024?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I, you know, just want to preface, I came in the middle of the 2022 cycle. So, you know, I didn't get to see it from the start until, you know, through to the finish line. But I came in pretty much in the thick of it. And I think there's a lot of different dynamics at play. Most obviously, you have a switch in party control in the House. So where Democrats in 2022 were coming in sort of as the underdog, now they kind of have to defend the House and come out swinging a little bit more. And I think there's a little bit higher expectations. Fundraising looks a little bit different. I know the Republicans have been really touting their cash on hand. Democrats have raised a little bit more. So there's an interesting dynamic there. And then, oh gosh, other than that, I think just what we have on the ballot this time, you know, it being a presidential primary instead of having the governor on the ballot, having the Secretary of State and the AG, having these proposals, you know, proposal 1 through 3 with a lot of, you know, everything from abortion to financial disclosure. I think it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out with a different top of the ballot as well.
And I have a second question for you, Danny. I mean, what is the top primary election that you're most zoomed in on right now going into the month of May?
That's a great question. And there's a few races that I think are really interesting and have the potential to be very interesting. But for me, especially in the last several days, specifically with some of the reporting I've been doing, the top primary I'm looking at is the 50th district. And the dynamics in that race are super unique. You have 5 candidates still in the race after this withdrawal deadline on Friday, and 4 of those are Republicans. You have incumbent Rep. Bob Bizzat, who previously announced he wouldn't be running for re-election and then got back into the race the week of the filing deadline, along with these 3 other Republicans, Christina Like, Jason Wolford, and Dominic Restuccia. And apologies if I mispronounced his name, because that one was a little more difficult for me. But anyways, now, because Bizzat was out of the race from January until April, and then he jumped back in very last minute, you'll see something in this race that you likely won't find in many other, or if any, districts. And that's an endorsement from one opponent to another, even though it's sort of been, you know, obviously walked back in the last few days. So Bizzat previously endorsed both Wolford and Like, both of whom he had personal friendships with outside of politics, and both of whom are now pretty upset about the whole affair. I know Wolford and Like both talked to me last week about how they felt Bizzat went back on his word when he jumped back into the race. Wolford said Bizzat asked him to run, and he said he's received an outpouring of support and, you know, 10 new campaign volunteers who believed Bizzat shouldn't have gotten back in and, you know, reached out to him and were pretty upset about the whole thing. While Bizzat said he didn't ask Wolford to run. So now there's also this interesting back and forth that doesn't quite line up between the two. That's the race that I'm really looking at right now.
Okay, Maggie, this is your first ever election cycle on the MERS team. I mean, what primary has you a bit nerding out?
I'm nerding out about the whole thing because, like you said, this is my first run through of this whole thing, especially in a capacity where we are looking at every primary. One election that I'm very excited about is the 109th district, which is currently held by incumbent Representative Jen Hill. After, there were lots of conversations last year about how she was voting on local control, solar siting, that sort of thing. And a lot of Democrats jumped into the race to primary her, including, pardon me, Margaret Brum, who brought up a lot of questions about how long has Jen Hill been in this district? Is she representing local concerns and that sort of thing? So I'm very interested to see how that plays out.
Okay, what about you, Kyle? What's running through your mind in terms of interesting primaries?
Well, I've taken a look at a couple. Latonya Garrett came in and is facing Helena Scott in the 7th district. And that's a bit of a different race because with Latonya Garrett, obviously, or the 8th district, rather, the 8th district, they used to represent the 7th, now they're in the 8th. Latonya Garrett, that district, when she represented it in Detroit, did not include Ferndale and didn't include parts of the current iteration, which is different from the iteration that Helena Scott had in 2022 when she ran that seat. But the Scott district looks a lot more like the current one that has gotten redrawn through the redistricting process than the Latonya Garrett one did. So while Latonya Garrett has a bit more of experience being a legislator, having been a three-termer, Scott may have the edge in this one because she's actually represented Ferndale and parts of Detroit that Latonya Garrett did not. So that's going to be a kind of a name game, but also who has represented more of this district. I'm curious to watch that one.
We have mentioned a lot of district numbers, but zooming in on geography, I mean, what areas, what terrains do you think are going to be the areas to look out for in the 2024 primary elections? Are we thinking Detroit? Are we thinking Oakland County suburbs? Are we thinking Upper Peninsula, Marquette? You had Maggie mention Jen Hill. What geographical jurisdictions are you all keeping your eyes on?
I don't know if the primaries, there's a geographical trend that we're seeing. When you start getting into the general election, the focus will be on the downriver area, Macomb County, and then for the Democrats, Oakland County, and how far can they push their popularity out there. But it seems to me that the competitive primaries, as I'm looking at the top 10 races to watch, and then also we did a top 10 primaries to watch, they were very spread out. There's some in Grand Rapids that are interesting. There's some in Oakland County. There's some in Detroit. And there's some up north as well. Betsy Cofia's had an opponent on the Republican side, and now that opponent has an opponent. And so that works out to her advantage to see Lisa Trombley all of a sudden get a primary from this Kate Nyss, who gave John Roth all sorts of problems up north. So that's going to be a super competitive primary. So to answer your question, Sam, they're all over the place.
Yeah, I think you can pretty much take a pin or a dart and, throw it at the wall if the wall is a map of Michigan, and you'll be able to find something interesting right now.
Okay, so Danny, which state house incumbent do you think could easily be perceived as the most vulnerable right now? And that could be in terms of a primary or especially in terms of a general election as we look toward November.
See, that's really interesting you ask, because I think my answer is the same as Maggie's for the one that she's, most interested or most honed in on. I think Jen Hill, she has two primary opponents and four Republicans running against her, meaning she'll have to really put up a fight in both the primary and the general elections. But one of the things that I really looked at was this Republican candidate, Carl Bonack. Sorry, Carl, if I've mispronounced your name, but if he makes it through the primary, he could be a really tough opponent for Hill. He's an author. He was a chief meteorologist at WLUC TV in the UP from, I think, 1988 until 2021, which is a ton of face time and, name recognition in the district. And his campaign slogan is, forecasting a brighter tomorrow. So he's definitely playing to his strengths there with that one.
How about you, Maggie? Which incumbent are you thinking is in the hot seat?
Well, that's an interesting question because, the race in the capacity of incumbents that I'm looking at the most is for Mai Sung, who is, she won the special election for the 13th district, But now we're looking at the 13th district, which has been redistricted. And that's the seat that former Representative Steenland, Richard Steenland, has decided that he's running for as well after, you know, he's been following all of this redistricting drama happening out of the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. And he decided that after this year, this seat was looking more like the seat that he held previously, that he won in 2020. And at the time, it was a 22nd House district when he held it. He lost when it got redistricted as the 12th district and parts of Wayne County were drawn in. And now he's looking at this district as it's been redrawn again after my son has won it and saying, this looks like a seat that I could win. And, you know, it's not uncommon for people to lose to somebody who has political experience on their resume. It's not uncommon for somebody to lose after winning a special election or to lose after redistricting. But for all those things to happen to an incumbent in 1 year is very fascinating to me. And I am excited to see how that plays out.
You know, now that we're talking about Warren, I also want to look at the 14th State House District, including Warren and Madison Heights. Did former Mayor Jim Fouts end up turning in the necessary documents to be a filed candidate in that district?
Yeah, amazingly. Yeah. You know, running for the State House is super easy. All you got to do is file $100 and fill your paperwork out correctly, and you're on the ballot. It's a lot different than running for Congress, where you actually got to put together 1,000 valid signatures. So Fouts is a very interesting one to watch, Sam, and I'm glad you mentioned it because that's certainly one we'll all be looking out for. Obviously, he wanted to run for mayor again, but the court said the city's term limit law wouldn't let him do it. So now he's running for the State House against a first-termer, Mike McFaul, and that district got redrawn. So that is not going to be an easy re-election for him. And then, you know, with Fouts on the ballot, he's got a lot of name ID and Warren. It's good news there. For the you know, the rest of the area of that district, I don't know if it's as favorable. It's about a 50-50 as far as the folks who live in the area that Fouts is represented and the area that McFaul has represented. That one's really a coin flip, Sam. It could go either way.
I do find it interesting that he has run as a Republican before and that he said that his political ideologies have evolved over time and now he's running as a Democrat. But I wonder, and I'll ask this, Kyle, because you've been covering various primaries for decades now. Can I say decades?
Oh, God, I wish you wouldn't.
But, you know, is there repercussions in a Democratic primary if you're someone who has run in both sides for both teams? If you've been a Republican, if you've been a Democrat, will those loyal Democratic primary voters be in no way, Jose?
I don't think in the case of Fouts, because I don't think that he connects with a party ideology. As mayor, he always just ran nonpartisan. And so I don't know how many people even remember that he ran as a Republican, to be honest. So I don't, it does impact some candidates in certain districts if it's a complete reinvention of themselves. But for Fouts, it's not really a complete reinvention. It's just been kind of a gradual evolution. And maybe kind of a political necessity. So I don't think that's going to get him. You know, if Fouts doesn't win, it's because people are tired of Fouts, not because he used to be a Republican.
Okay, now let's talk about the Freedom Caucus. And just to confirm, Kyle, didn't you tell me that every Freedom Caucus member is facing a primary challenger at this point?
Well, except Jim DeSanta. He got away with not getting one. But yeah, every other one has. And there's, you know, it's debate whether you want to count Representative Fox and Shriver as Freedom Caucus members. If you do, they got primaries as well. Angela Regas, who was in the Freedom Caucus, did not get one. And of course, Beeler's not running this time, so he doesn't have a primary.
Okay. Hey, Danny, could you explain to our listeners who do not know what exactly is the Freedom Caucus?
Yeah, so the Freedom Caucus is a sect of the Republican Party. I think at its height, it was around 7 or 8 people, but they pride themselves on, you know, not voting, you know, not towing the party line and voting very independently with things that they agree with or disagree with. So typically, if you see a pretty close to unanimous vote on the board and there's 5 or 6 red names, that's Freedom Caucus members. They're very conservative, you know, varying degree of Trump support. And a lot of them are a little more on the, you know, far right side compared to other Republican Party members.
So based off of what you're covering right now, Danny, I mean, who do you think appears to be the most vulnerable Freedom Caucus member in terms of primary challenges?
Yeah, so I'm looking at it as Freedom Caucus, you know, then and now, just sort of lumped together. And I would say, you know, there's definitely a few really interesting primaries right now in terms of very vocal opponents that have come out in the last several weeks. But the one that I'm most focused on is Representative Matt Maddock in the 51st. Maddock is being primaried by a Milford City Council member, Kevin Ziegler, who also has some connections in the private dental space and who released a really fiery statement in opposition of Maddock, I think it was last week. So Ziegler said he's primarying Maddock over his no vote on Representative Lori Pohetsky's legislation closing a spousal rape defense loophole. And that was one of the examples that I talked about earlier about, you know, five or six red names on the board. There were only a few members that voted against that legislation, and those were all Freedom Caucus members. And so Ziegler said he found out about this vote, I think a month or two ago, and it really upset him. He was uncomfortable with it, and he decided to primary Maddock. He also made some mention. He said, Maddock made an international clown of himself, that is a quote, when he made this post on X about a month ago, mistaking the Gonzaga men's basketball team during March Madness for a busload of illegal immigrants. He also, Ziegler, won MERS quote of the day for this snippet, which I'll read off right now. The last time I saw Matt Maddock at a parade, kids were throwing the hard candy he was tossing out back at him. I mean, really, the only reason kids come to parades, unless they or a family member are in them, is to get candy. What does it take to get them to throw it back? That's got to be a sign of what their parents think of the representation they are getting in Lansing. And Maddock responded, calling his primary challenger sad. And he said his primary challenger, Ziegler, is running on a campaign of lies and bitterness. He is a third-term House member and a strong Trump supporter who has connected several other candidates in 2022 with a Trump endorsement. So that could be sort of a tick in his favor. And, you know, he is a third-term House member. He's been reelected before. So, you know, we'll see how that one plays out. But I just thought those statements were really interesting, and that drew my attention. So
I feel like with this challenger having ties to the private dental industry, I want to see how many root canal jokes are in the mix.
I'm sure many, yeah.
Okay, Maggie, what are your Freedom Caucus thoughts at this point in time?
I'm also operating under the same understanding of the Freedom Caucus as Danny, past and present members. So Representative Josh Shriver in the 66th District, his primary opponent is a real estate broker and attorney named Randy Levasseur. And he said that he was approached by members in the district after Representative Shriver had tweeted some content about the great replacement theory, which he ended up being condemned through a House resolution, a vote of the members in the House for what he was posting. And Levasseur said that that wasn't the only reason he was approached, but, you know, he's run before and wasn't successful, but he kind of saw this as his opportunity to bring a, I guess, like more Reagan era conservatism to representation in the district. And Shriver's response to having this primary opponent is, he, you know, he's standing on his title of most conservative legislator, which came from a story that MERS wrote at the end of 2023 based on voting records, saying that running against an incumbent with that title is not a good use of energy or resources. But, you know, there's other things that Levasseur is looking at besides the tweets, you know, voting records on certain things that he thinks could have gone a different way. And he also thinks that, you know, Shriver has a focus, I guess, on representing, you know, the will of God and what he thinks he was sent to Lansing to represent. And Levasseur has more of a constituent and, you know, faith-based ideology there, where he says you're not just doing one. You're not dishonoring God by representing the will of your constituents, and you're not dishonoring the will of your constituents by honoring the will of God. You can do both at the same time. So that's another one that I think is going to be very interesting this year.
I do not mean this to be an insensitive joke. I'm asking with pure journalistic intentions, but do you or do you not think that there will be a freestyle rap competition in this district?
Well, competition implies that there's multiple people participating. I don't know that Randy Levasseur has much interest in that, but that's not to say that we won't see one side of that race coming from Representative Shriver, you know, putting out some content. We've seen it in the past. He also produced a short music video after the story where we crowned him the most conservative legislator. He created a music video. So we very may well see some rap content come out of there.
Yeah, I was sort of bummed about that one, Maggie, that music video specifically, because in the video he references just the news and he doesn't talk about me specifically. And I was the one who called him for that. So I was pretty hurt I didn't get a shout out.
Oh, I wouldn't be too shook up about that, Danny.
Kyle, what are your thoughts right now in terms of Freedom Caucus? Do you have anything else you want to add?
I just think that it's interesting that these Freedom Caucus members have primaries against credible opponents. I was taking a look at the Neil Friske primary and up there in the 107th district with Parker Fairbairn or Fairbairn. That's a very credible opponent. The two ran against each other in 2022. It was very close. Neil Friske did win. This time it is not a divided primary. The other person who had run, Jackson Emery Ingalls, has decided not to run and is backing Parker. And so we're seeing that kind of the division within the Republican Party that we reported on, for the first half of this year and last year regarding Christina Karamo is kind of really materializing in these primaries. You already heard Danny and Maggie talk about theirs, but even up north, Parker Fairbairn against Neil Friske, and then you got Cam Cavett, who's running against Todd Smallenberg. Remember that there was a recall effort against Cam Cavett, and his sin was that he voted for Joe Tate for speaker, which is really a ceremonial vote, or it has been in recent history. And this Todd Smallenberg is kind of that ultra MAGA ilk, the same type as Matic and Shriver and Friske. So we're seeing that. And then I think also getting back to the 103rd with Katie Nis and Lisa Trombley, kind of the same kind of thing. Katie Nis being of maybe that more ultra MAGA style, and Lisa Trombley being more kind of the traditional Republican, Traverse City Republican type. So just examples of where you're seeing the Republican Party now, the tensions that had been Karamo and Pete Hoekstra, we're seeing them in various other instances across the state in state house primaries.
Before we end, Kyle, do you have anything you want to say about our election guide and almanac that is being developed right now? We obviously dropped a lot of names. Those names will be coming in print soon.
It will be, and we've got a real good head start here on our election guide and almanac. We believe it's going to come out earlier than it has been. But for our subscribers, if you want to look at what we have right now, we have I would dare say 70 to 75% of the bios for candidates have already been written by Maggie, Danny, myself. We've been working on this for months, literally. And you can find it on our website right now. If you go to our homepage and go to reports, the drop-down menu for reports, you'll see something for election guide. And you can read our election guide if you're a subscriber right now online. And you can click on, whatever candidate. Like I said, 25% of them, maybe we don't have, they filed, last minute. So we're compiling their information right now. But we've got a lot of good content on there, and I'd encourage our subscribers to check it out if they want to know more about who's running against whom.
Everybody, that is MERS editor Kyle Malin, the MERS State House reporter Danielle James, and of course, our political reporter Maggie George. Thank you all so much for taking the time to join me on today's podcast episode.
Woohoo!
Excellent. Thank you, Sam.
Joining us for our middle segment of the MERS Monday podcast is first-term legislator, State Senator Veronica Kleinfeld, an East Point Democrat. Before coming to the state capitol, she previously served on the Macomb County Board of Commissioners for 10 years and has been the president of the Michigan Association of Counties. Hello, Senator Kleinfeld. How are you doing today?
Doing good. Hello.
So, Senator Kleinfeld, your name has been appearing in multiple articles this week because you have introduced a three-bill package this term to set up distinct criminal penalties and sentencing guidelines for necrophilia, the sexual abuse or assault of dead bodies. Particularly, your bill makes sexual contact with a dead body a $500 2-year misdemeanor and penetration with a corpse a 15-year felony. Senator Kleinfeld, how did you get involved in this topic and took up sponsoring these bills?
It originally came from our caucus. They wanted us to take a look at it and see if we were interested in working on it. And we connected with the individual, Rick Roher, whose wife was murdered. And this was an issue that had happened with regard to that incident. And he was really passionate about doing something to make a law so that individuals that commit acts like this are convicted of the particular act. And we really felt for the family, but we also realized this is a glaring loophole in our legal system, and we need to do something to take care of it.
Yeah. So what exactly happens now in cases of necrophilia?
Well, there may be other crimes that you can charge an individual with, but you can't charge them with a sexual assault or a rape crime. And as I was doing research on this, I realized other states that did not have this particular law, the courts were grappling with some of the convictions that had taken place. In one state, the court held that the individual did commit the act because the body could not consent. In another state, they said the individual is not guilty because, let's see, how did they say it? Because they're not human beings. And so that conviction was set aside. And we realized the court shouldn't have to grapple with this. We should be dealing with this directly and giving them clear and concise legislation that they have to deal with when these cases arise.
Senator, did you see other states have criminalized this?
There are several states that have criminalized it. I can't name them off right now, but as I was doing my research, I was seeing state after state that had done it, and several of them not in too distant past. So I think these court cases have arisen around the country, and legislatures have realized that they needed to address the issue and have followed up and addressed the issue, and that's what we're doing here.
Do you think that this kind of crime is so heinous and kind of unthinkable that may be why we don't have a law on the books right now about this? Like who would ever think of doing something like this? So that's why we don't have a law right now.
You know, it may be, and it may be, it just, the other thing is, I think folks just assumed we did. Every legislator I've talked to had assumed we already had laws on the books, and we don't. And it may be rare, but I read an article about an individual who worked in a morgue that had violated over 100 bodies in that morgue. So this is a thing that does happen, and there does need to be a conviction and a record. And also the folks need to be on a sex offender registry in case they ever get out of prison. We're calling it Melody's Law to honor the woman at the family's request. This is going to be a big accomplishment for them. And we certainly thank them for working with us and bringing this to our attention to begin with, because it's important.
I have two questions. And the first one is related to who the bills are named after, Melody's Law, Melody Roher, and how in July 2023, so last summer, the individual involved in her death was found guilty of first degree murder, concealing the death of an individual, and failing to stop the scene of an accident. However, he did not receive penalties, according to the Democratic press release you all had out. He didn't receive any penalties for sexually assaulting her body after her death, correct?
He did not. And that is an action that there should be a penalty for, there should be a record of, there should be a conviction of. And quite frankly, it's just so concerning that you want to make sure that individual does not ever enter back into society and have the opportunity to do that again.
So what was it like for your office to work with that family, especially with it still being a fresh wound with this individual just being found guilty last summer?
You know, they've communicated so often, they build feelings towards these individuals, right? My legislative director fondly talks of Rick, which is the husband, and her desire to help him get this taken care of. You can't help but build a relationship with the family and feel empathy for them, but also feel like you really want to help them out in this process, because I think what they're doing is the right thing.
And what's your anticipated timeline for this legislation of how soon you hope it moves through?
I don't know the timeline. I hope it moves through quickly. Quite frankly, I don't see very much opposition. I haven't talked to anybody yet that has opposition to it. And I've talked to several people. Most legislators, like I said, already thought it was on the books. But even stakeholders and even those that defend people that have committed criminal acts, every single one of them indicated that they did not have a problem with this being against the law.
Did you ever imagine when you were running for the state Senate that this would be the type of bill that you would put forward?
Certainly didn't see this bill coming. I am a senator that likes to do a lot of good government bills and take care of things that were missed, common sense bills. And this fits being a common sense bill. So it's sort of right up my alley with respect to that.
Okay, so we're going to take a bit of an unusual pivot. So we are going to go from talking about necrophilia to now talking about the transportation budget. You obviously serve Senator Kleinfeld as chair of the Senate Transportation Appropriations Subcommittee, which plays a role in developing our state's transportation and infrastructure budget for the new fiscal years. For the next state budget, you're proposing that the state put aside $5 million from the general fund for a road usage charge study to explore ways Michigan's gas tax for road funding could be replaced, such as through a miles traveled user fee. I'll just kick off the conversation. What exactly is going on with that in your mind?
Well, we know, number one, that vehicles that use gas have become much more fuel efficient. And we know there are a lot more electric vehicles on the road. And the electric vehicles, we are not capturing any taxes on to maintain the roads. And they are heavier vehicles. We know that in the future, the car companies see themselves heading towards all electric vehicles. And we have to address the issue. And there's been discussion for years, but not action. So we felt we've studied it. It's time to start the ball rolling. And the best way to do that is a pilot program, because in a pilot program where you have individuals that are doing it, you see the problems that arise. You see if there are quirks, if there are things that need to be fixed, if there's problems with security, those types of things. So it really, we need to test it because we're talking about a whole new system.
So basically with a pilot program, what you're doing is you're asking MDOT to put together a commission who will then organize a group of volunteers to have some type of tracking system or do some type of advanced technology where they are paying taxes based on how far they drive. And then as opposed to them paying the gas tax, they would be refunded for any gas tax they pay during that period of time.
Yes. Now, it hasn't been determined the manner in which the information will be collected, that's up to the committee. So whether it's a device or it's a reporting, there could be a reporting every 6 months, you have to report your miles. There are different options out there. So we've created a committee process where there are individuals in the industry that are experts. There are vehicle owners that will have input. We've got Democrats on that committee and Republicans on that committee, all different kinds of stakeholders. We want to make sure that everybody's included in the process of creating the pilot program.
How long do you think we are away from transitioning away from the gas tax toward a vehicle miles traveled tax? Are we like 5 years, 10 years, 20 years away?
I honestly can't answer that because obviously it's such a major shift and it's going to depend on the mood of the legislature as to whether or not they feel they can pull the trigger on it eventually. I think the longer we hold off and we're not collecting those taxes, the worse our local roads will be, because our local roads are already really suffering and the dollar amount we're bringing in is only going to continue to decline.
In a perfect world, what does the perfect user fee look like to you? Just for yourself personally, not even speaking as a legislator.
For me, in a perfect world, any new vehicles are being created by car companies that know exactly how many miles those vehicles are driving, right? You get a light on that tells you it's time to change your oil because they know exactly how many miles you've driven. So for me, in a perfect world, we're just taking that data and being able to put it to use. But I don't think that's an option that's on the table. So we have to come up with something that residents can be comfortable with, is accurate, their information is secure, and we can bring in enough revenue to take care of the roads.
I mean, how powerful do you think the Big Brother argument even is at this point, especially now that we live in a society where there's just so much comfort in having your phone in your pocket at all times?
I know there are residents that are very passionate about it, but it is ironic because there are cameras on every corner, right? Our phones are tracked. Everything we do is tracked. Our computers are tracked. Everything that we do is tracked right now already. It's just by different individuals. And in this case, we're not trying to get extra private information. We're not particularly concerned about who you're visiting or where you've been. We are strictly concerned of the mile usage that you're using, so we know how to appropriately apply a charge so that we can maintain the roads. You know, we don't want to charge a senior citizen that's driving under 5,000 miles a year the same amount of money that we charge somebody that drives 80,000 miles a year. That wouldn't be fair. So early on, I realized doing it through registration really wouldn't be a fair way to do it. Ultimately, we need to know how much people are driving so that we know how to properly and fairly assess.
Senator, I saw that the House has put something similar in their appropriations bill. Have you had a chance to look at it? And how similar is it to what you put out?
We just got that yesterday. I have not had the opportunity to review it with my staff yet. I think there are a lot of similarities because we both were in discussions with the County Road Association that has been looking at this issue for a long time, quite concerned, obviously, about the dropping of revenues. So I imagine that they will be somewhat similar. I don't know how similar. Any differences can be reconciled, and any issues the department has with the boilerplate language we've put into the budget, I'm open to negotiations as long as we can get to the bottom line of putting something together and at least get a pilot program off the ground.
What is a dream project you have that you wish you could have put into this budget recommendation, but it just was not logistically or financially possible?
Oh, I have 100 dream projects that I could put in. If I had billions of dollars, I'd like to have a subway system. The cities that have subway systems thrive. They tend to do very well. Younger families like to have mass transit, obviously. We don't have that kind of money. So those sorts of things aren't an option.
But you do include like $30 million for one-time grants for transit innovation. You also include a $45 million for local bus operations. I mean, isn't that kind of kicking off the conversation as well here?
It's at least shoring up where our bus situation is now. It's been difficult for them to attract and maintain workers and maintain fleets in some of the areas. And that transit is so important because local businesses depend on that transit because a lot of the workers use public transit to get to the jobs. And so without it, it creates a shortage of workers, particularly with smaller stores. So I do think it's very important. And also just for the individuals themselves, I think a lot of the younger generation is getting away from the type of travel that we're used to. And if we want to be a state that attracts younger families instead of them leaving to other states, we need to be looking at public transit.
Are you concerned about the long-term viability of road funding here in Michigan with the bonding money running out and, you know, there being a certain, I don't know, cap on what we're going to get for the federal dollars?
I am concerned about it. We fix the roads, but we primarily fix state roads. The local roads have continued to deteriorate because we haven't fixed the financial structure of the money we bring in now. The added stress of having to be concerned about paying the bonds just puts another layer of stress on the system. I mean, at some point, there will be a breaking point We have not properly funded roads for years, and we're seeing it on our local roads when we drive. We're seeing the results of that. So it is a concern of mine. I do know putting this in the budget is controversial, but it's getting things going. The public transit and the pilot program, we're at least saying, you know, we need to put an emphasis on how we move around, and we need to try to fix problems financially to support these systems.
What do you think about the public transit conversation, though? I mean, is that something that we're going to see in our lifetime, or is that something that's going to take decades and decades to build?
Oh, I think it would take decades to build. To be honest with you, I think the cost to put in the types of systems that other communities have, it just isn't feasible at this time. So we've got to be innovative and find other ways to move people around effectively. And it may be piece by piece. You know, there may come a time where there's a huge federal infrastructure package that is strictly regarding mass transit. I don't see it coming down the road. And without a federal program, I just don't think financially the state and the cities could do it by themselves. Not something as grand as that. But at least looking at maybe increasing the rail rides that we have right now and modernizing the buses, which is being done, and increasing the buses, it at least helps. It at least helps with the moving of people around and helping them get where they need to go.
We are near the end of time. Is there anything else that you want to zoom in on before we say goodbye?
No, I thank you for inviting me on to have this conversation. I think the more that we are talking about it publicly and getting residents talking about it so that we can engage with them and bring in their feedback, it's very helpful. So thank you very much for having me on.
Everybody, that is State Senator Veronica Kleinfeld, a East Point Democrat. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the MERS Monday podcast.
You have a good day.
Final segment of the MERS Monday podcast. And before I dive into my usual explanation of what exactly it is we will be discussing, I'm going to introduce our guest right away. Welcome to the podcast, Robert McCann, the Executive Director of the K-12 Alliance of Michigan, an education policy and advocacy coalition of more than 100 school districts in major areas like Macomb, Oakland, Genesee, and Wayne counties. Hey, Robert, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Before we get started, I kind of want to let our listeners know how we ended up establishing this podcast segment, which we planned probably within the last 24 hours.
Indeed, we did.
I was sitting in the House School Aid Appropriations Subcommittee and talking to a few individuals in the room of how I really wanted to do a podcast segment about the Michigan Public School Employees Retirement System, MPSRS for short. I was like, you know, I really want to do this segment. There's so many different like budget proposals circulating right now, but I want to do it in a way that is digestible for listeners in a podcast format. So that type of prospect I found quite intimidating. So I was fairly transparent while talking to a few people in the room. And then after Chair Representative Regina Weiss had gaveled in, I nonchalantly look at my email. And who is in my inbox? It's you, Robert, saying, hey, word just got to me that you're trying to do this podcast segment.
word travels fast in this town sometimes, right? So, yeah, unfortunately, I'm on crutches right now, so wasn't in the hearing in person, but I got a text from someone that said, hey, Sam's looking to do a podcast on this. If you're interested, you should touch base with her. So I did, and here we are.
I feel like it's both a blessing and a curse that I'm a fairly loud talker, too.
I can't say for sure if you talk directly to the person that flagged it to me or not, but one way or the other, it worked out, right?
I feel like I was just hollering, somebody help me talk about MPSRS, please.
I got the bat signal. So yes, it worked out all right.
So I'm going to try diving into the situation right now for our listeners. Michigan currently owes, as of December of last year, more than $34.96 billion in unfunded liability for the retirement pensions of public school employees. However, When it comes to non-pension unfunded liability within MIPSRS for retirees' healthcare benefits, not pensions, or OPEB, the other post-employment benefits, the Michigan Office of Retirement Services has reported that the debt is 126.9% funded as of September 30th of 2023. Now we're hit with two questions that we're going to be addressing on the podcast here today. Should the state view pension debt and retiree healthcare debt, the OPEB, as two separate things within MIPSRS and allow more than $680 million to be freed up to go toward other things instead of what would otherwise be a supplemental payment into already paid for OPEB debt in the new budget? Here's the second question, and this is why we have you on, Robert. Should that money be used on new forms of school funding, like on free lunches and reading programs? Or should it go toward now taking over the bill for school districts and teachers' mandated contributions into MIPSRS debt? How did I do?
That's a pretty good explanation of where we're at this point and where the discussion is. And yeah, you know, as we learned a couple months ago of the OPEB side, the healthcare side of the retirement fund being fully funded, it really started to ask the question on our end in terms of those in charge of running schools of what is the best opportunity in front of us, given these unexpected and really kind of a once in a generation opportunity in front of us here. And as we took a look at it, we realized that the best opportunity for us is to start directly and permanently alleviating the overall debt that schools have been forced to pay for years and years now into the system. And when I say that this is a significant anchor on public school funding, that's probably underselling it, because the reality is for every number of the per pupil allotment that any school district gets, they are sending a significant chunk of that directly back to Lansing to cover these debts. In total, we're talking in the ballpark of $670 million that we could free up this year if the state does this the correct way. And the correct way is having the state continue to make their own obligated payments into the system. They're known as Section 147 payments. And doing that would start directly paying down the rate that school districts have to pay. And again, we're talking $670 million spread over every school district in the state. It'll vary from district to district, but we're talking $500 per pupil on average that would be freed up, meaning you're not allocating more money, but the schools can spend more of it on student programming, on teacher salaries, on the things we know we need in our classrooms, instead of having to send that money back to Lansing. So we look at this as really a win-win across the board, in that we're talking a significant investment in public education without a need for new or increased taxes, without a need to cut anything else in the budget. This is something that has a tremendous, tremendous opportunity to permanently better our school funding system in Michigan.
So obviously right now there's a lot of talk around Lansing about the state's obligations to paying off MIPSRS debt. Could you go into a little bit more detail about what those obligations look like for an individual school district as well as an individual teacher's paycheck?
Yeah, this goes back into the early parts of Governor Snyder's administration when they realized that the unfunded liabilities in these retirement systems were so out of control at that point that something really needed to be done to stabilize them. And they took some difficult but frankly necessary steps to ensure that these funds were going to be paid off over a period of time and the systems themselves made whole. And part of that deal was that school districts and teachers would be on the hook for part of that debt relief that needed to be paid into the system, and then the state would pay the rest. That's what became known as these Section 147 payments that the state made. As anything above a certain cap that they put in place on schools would be picked up by the state. So where the schools have to pay out is every single salary that a school pays from an employee. Every school district has to pay 21% on top of that salary to the state to cover these debt payments, which means for every $1,000 in a salary, you're paying an extra $210. So if you're hiring a teacher or whoever at $50,000, that means the cost to the district is $60,500. What this has done over the last 10 years is not only take billions of dollars out of out of public education and put it into a debt program, but it has both made it harder for us to increase teacher salaries, because for every $1,000 we're increasing in salary, we're actually increasing it more than that. And it's also been part of what has frankly led to a lot of privatization of services in schools because of this 21% tax, so to speak, on salaries of direct hires. If you're hiring someone as a contractor or through a third-party vendor, you don't have to pay that. And so if we start reducing that, not only does it make it easier for us to give raises and things like that, but it incentivizes bringing employees back into the direct hire system. Now, where the teachers had to pay into this was for those that chose to continue to remain in the healthcare retirement system, and they were given a choice, and the system became closed when this deal, so no new teachers hired after this that deal was signed can even get into the system currently. But for those that are still in the system, they have to pay 3% of their salary into that to continue to receive that as a retirement benefit when they leave office. So again, this is something that has cost schools significant amounts of money. This is something that has, you know, again, made it harder for us to employ teachers because, you know, not only are we not giving them the salaries and benefits that they want, but they're being charged 3% of their salary to even keep these kind of benefits that we want to provide them. And again, this is an opportunity to start correcting that and moving in the right direction, because, you know, we are costing students opportunities. We are costing a generation of students things that help them succeed in and out of the classroom. And if we have an opportunity to start writing that ship, boy, would we be missing an opportunity if we didn't.
I just want to make sure I'm clear on what is being done here. And we're talking about the House proposal. What would happen if the state didn't do anything in regards to adjusting what we do with the OPEB costs, the healthcare retiree benefits? If no proposal ended up being put on the table to address that portion of it is properly funded, what would happen?
Yeah, when you look back at the budget that Governor Whitmer introduced, you know, her proposal was looking at it from the sense of the OPEB fund is now fully funded. That means we can take the money that the state had been paying into it and pay for, you know, specific programming that we want to choose to invest in. That's a well-intentioned idea. And I think, you know, it was meant as a means of providing additional funding to education. But there were some consequences with that. And the major consequence of it would be that if the state stopped paying in its share, it ensures that the fund is never fully funded, hitting 140%, which is a trigger point to allow schools to start paying less. Meaning if you stop paying the state share in, schools would forever be having to pay this debt off going forward. So, you know, not only would we be continuing to make these debt payments, but we'd be at the whim of future legislators to, you know, provide some relief for that. We took a long look at this and realized that there is a better way of doing this that not only keeps the system intact and funded appropriately and healthy, but gives schools significant new spending power in return and does that permanently going forward. Because remember here, we're not just talking about a $500 per pupil spending increase on average, but that's a permanent increase going forward, meaning that regardless of what any legislature allocates to school funding going forward, schools would be able to spend more of that on their students. And that is
right. But what if she had not even recommended that though, Bob? What if she had just said nothing about OPEB being over? What would have happened?
Well, that's essentially what we're asking for, is that the state continue to make their Section 147 payments. What we're just saying is what you did last year, keep doing it. And that's what ultimately is going to make that the overall debt relief go down on the school level, because the OPEB fund is hitting that 140% trigger point, which then starts paying down the debt on the school side of things. So yeah, exactly what we're asking for is essentially keep doing what you've been doing.
Okay, I need to get a little bit tedious for a quick second. Okay, absolutely. So I know that it is currently a 20.96% UAA L contribution cap that district needs to contribute to. What is that 20.96% coming from? Is it their overall operational budget?
That's where I was mentioning the teacher, the salaries of employees. It's a 20.96, or if we want to round up to 21, a 21% penalty, essentially, you have to pay for every employee that you hire. So again, if you're hiring an employee at $50,000, 21% of that is another $10,500 that you are paying to the state for the, simple fact of hiring that person. So yeah, every single employee a school district has, they are paying 21% on top of that right back to the state. So, when I say it's an average of $500 per pupil we could save this year, it's going to vary from district to district depending on their payroll, essentially. So it's a 21% tax on payroll.
You had dropped the term of having to make those contributions until MIPSERS is 140% funded for. What do you mean by that?
It was just simply a trigger put into the deal made under Governor Snyder of when they would consider the fund truly fully funded, that it didn't want to just hit 100% and say, hey, we're done, because that was going to, allow the system to start sliding backwards again. They wanted it to hit a higher number than that before these rates started to truly get paid down. So it was just part of a deal that was made. I couldn't tell you why it was that number or not a different number. Frankly, we couldn't tell you why it was 3% for teachers or why it's, overall 21% for schools. It was just, these were numbers negotiated by people, over a decade ago that are, it was well-intentioned and frankly, it did work in terms of stabilizing the funds as we're seeing today. But it's been a real anchor on school funding for a number of years now and has, frankly, deprived our students of significant opportunities in the classroom.
Bob, I want to change the subject just a little bit here. How
Sure.
concerned are you about the long-term sustainability of the school aid fund?
Significantly. The way we fund our schools goes back to the 90s in terms of Proposal A. And you look where we're at today with the system, and it just isn't working. We've seen some significant steps in the right direction, particularly in the current year budget, in terms of how they are allocating funding, but it still isn't enough funding. And even though, every year we seem to see the legislature talk about record funding being put into the school system, that can be true, but it can also be true that you're still very significantly underfunding where it needs to be. If you look at, the School Finance Research Collaborative's work, the last time they updated the actual cost of educating a student was in 2021. And at that point, it was just a base cost was $10,421 per pupil. And here in 2024, we're still not, even particularly close to that number. And if we adjusted it again this year, it's probably well over $11,000 per
But when
pupil a year.
Republicans hear that, Bob, they hear you all just want to pay teachers more. And that's the cost that you're talking about, that you feel like teachers are being underfunded. And so we got to sink more money into it so they make more.
Everything is underfunded in the system, teachers included. There is not a school district in Michigan right now that isn't fighting to get more teachers into the system. There isn't a district in the state trying to incentivize keeping qualified teachers in the system and not leaving to go to the private sector. I mean, we are competing not just with each other in terms of schools, but we are competing with people deciding this isn't worth it for me anymore. I'm not getting the pay I need. I'm not getting the benefits I need. I'm dealing with significant issues in my school. I'm going to go to the private sector and make more money. And it's hard for us to compete with that if we can't offer the salary and benefits that we need to be doing. So, yes, teachers do need to be paid more. We need to be recruiting more people into the teaching profession. But ultimately, we need to be putting more money in everything in our classrooms. And that means hiring tutors, reading coaches, social workers, all of these things that, frankly, we know work, but aren't funded for adequately in the budget. It's a systemic problem that is going to require a systemic solution at some point. And I think it's time to start having those discussions at least.
I do just want to go back to the MIPSERS concept just one more time. So, in a
Absolutely.
perfect world, what do you want to happen to the 680 million? Do you want it to go to MIPSERS so that we reach 140% funded? Or do you want it to go right now to reducing those caps for the
Yeah,
districts?
that's essentially, those are two of the same things, basically. By continuing to make the state Section 147 payments into the MIPSR system, it will buy down the rate automatically that schools have to pay into it. So, my organization and a number of education organizations sent a letter to the legislature last week specifically saying our number one request in this budget is for the state to continue those Section 147 payments into the budget so that we can directly pay down that rate. And again, the result of that would be on average, a school can spend $500 per pupil more on student programming rather than sending it back to Lansing in debt payments.
So would you dare say that every time that the legislature has approved a higher per pupil foundation allowance, that we as reporters, we as observers, subtract that by 500 at least?
There's a lot of math involved in figuring out what that would be. But yes, the reality is every public school system in Michigan is paying a significant amount of that per pupil funding right back to Lansing. And it's worth noting that this is something that our traditional public schools have had to do for years, but charter schools mostly have not, because the vast majority of charter schools don't use the MIPSR system for their teachers. So they aren't forced to pay into that debt payment because they don't use the system at all. What that's done is create an imbalance in terms of school funding, that even though we consider charter schools and traditional schools both to be public schools and use the same formula for them, the charter schools get to keep all of that money in terms of the per pupil formula, while our traditional public schools have to give a significant amount of that right back to Lansing. So what this proposal would do is help create a better, a more level playing field anyway, in terms of the amount of that foundation money that traditional public schools can keep versus their charter school counterparts.
What are your thoughts on the House proposal that was just approved out of subcommittee this past week that uses 290.8 million that would have gone to that OPEB? Instead, they use it toward reducing districts' UAAL contribution cap from 20.96% to 18%, with the intention that that would be an ongoing appropriation until you hit zero for that cap.
I think it's a significant step in the right direction. We've obviously had a number of conversations with Representative Weiss as she was putting this budget together, and we know that this is a complicated thing to put together in a budget. It's a complicated thing to talk about, as we've discovered on this podcast here in the last 20 minutes or so. The ultimate goal here is for us to get the best plan possible put forward here, and I think Representative Weiss put together a plan that gets us some significant strides in that direction. I think we would love to work with her on making this as good as it can be, but we really do appreciate that she has put, sort of the framework of what we're talking about in the budget, so that we can now start talking about how to tweak it from there and how to make it even better, so that we are maximizing the opportunity that we have in front of us here.
I think my final question, and we talked over the phone about this, is what does the current lack of federal dollars mean for school spending?
Yeah, obviously over the last, 4-ish years of our school funding, we've had a significant amount of federal one-time dollars to include in that funding. Just in the ESSER II and the ESSER III programs that are still out there, in terms of funding still being spent, we're talking about $5.1 billion in Michigan schools that have been that are part of that funding and are drying up, frankly, at the end of the school year for the most part. What that's leaving us with is this fiscal cliff that we knew was coming all along, but was hard to plan for, because a lot of this funding was used by direction of the ESSER funds on things like tutors, reading coaches, social workers, the things that the federal government wanted us to spend it on to really help kids that had been, learning remotely for a year or two, get back on track to success, caught back up with reading, whatever help they needed. That's exactly what these funds were going towards. And now that they are drying up, we have districts facing real hard questions to make in terms of, can we continue to employ these people that we hired with this fund? And the unfortunate reality is, you're starting to see some stories about it in certain school districts, and I frankly think this is going to grow potential layoffs that are going to be coming because of this loss of federal funding. And frankly, the only way we're going to avert most of this is if we do something bold in this budget, much like I'm talking about with the MIPSR's money, that ultimately would free up a significant amount of spending in these school districts to offset that loss of federal funding that we know is it we're about to hit. So, it's a coincidence that the federal money is ending at the same time that we have this opportunity with the retirement funds, but it again just emphasizes the importance of maximizing the amount of money that schools can spend on teachers and students, because it's critically important to their success at this point. It's part of why we are stressing the importance of this, because obviously there isn't a school in Michigan that wants to even be having a conversation about layoffs, but when you're talking about a significant loss of federal funding in the upcoming year budget, it's hard to avoid it, frankly, for a lot of these districts, as impactful in a negative way as that's going to be on students.
Now, we are out of time, but everybody, that is Executive Director of the K-12 Alliance of Michigan, Robert McCann. Thank you so much for taking on the random bat signal I put out there and joining us on the MERS Monday podcast for our MIPSER segment.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. First off, thank you so much to our team who participated in a staff-led roundtable discussion on competitive primaries and vulnerable incumbents in the 2024 State House elections. I am tremendously grateful for MERS editor Kyle Mullen, House reporter Danielle James, and political reporter Maggie George. Moreover, I would like to thank our guests for today's episode. Thank you so much to State Senator Veronica Kleinfeld, an East Point Democrat, and Executive Director Robert McCann of the K-12 Alliance of Michigan for joining us on this week's episode. Both the interviews with Senator Kleinfeld and Robert were conducted on Friday, April 26th. Also, thank you so much to Jeff Smith, who's affiliated with Mark Bayshore Audio out in Okemos, for officially putting together today's audio. Until next time, I am your host, Samantha Schreiber.